Hey guys, welcome back to the channel. Welcome to another episode of Mark and Mitch Make a Scientology Film. Let's get Mitch in here.
Hey Mark.
Hey Mitch.
Great to see you again.
Good to see you again. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a little while. I understand you've been busy, which is a good thing.
Yes, I've been all over the country over the last weeks.
Great.
And but we're back. And today we have a special episode for you guys because we have tracked down one of the actors who appeared in many of the films that we've already covered. And without further ado, let me welcome you to Alan Barton.
Hello.
Welcome, Alan.
He's an actor, playwright.
Good to see you guys.
If I can say something before we go on, this is like the Jerry Springer show. You're seeing a reunion in real time, okay?
Yes.
Alan was a dear friend, a great actor, one of the people
this is literally our first conversation in over 20 years.
Yeah. Right? And so I just want the audience to understand you're seeing something very unpremeditated. This is live, spontaneous. Alan, I just want to reach through there and give you a hug. It's so great to see you.
Yeah.
My mind is just like bursting with all of these experiences that we had because, we were working for Scientology and it's an evil cult and all that, but we were artists doing our thing. And, at the time we thought we were doing something good. So I was so happy to see you.
Yeah. It's so great to see you. I'm so glad you made your way through and out and to see you. And you look exactly the same as I remember. You haven't been touched by age or years or anything. So whatever deal you made, I want it.
Yeah, there's a painting at my house in the closet that's aging very rapidly.
Okay, good.
So a portrait.
There you go.
The last time we spoke, Alan, was when you were writing a play called Disconnection.
Yeah.
What year was that?
That was the Disconnection happened in 2015, but you and I spoke while I was writing it in 2014 and 15, because there's a scene in the play between two Sea Org members, married Sea Org members. And I sent it to you basically for like, does this pass muster? Like, is this what a conversation would be like between two people who are facing this? In that circumstance, I really wanted to make sure that I had it right.
Yeah.
And so you helped me out by reading that scene and sort of saying, yep, that's pretty much how that might go.
Yes. So
we did two runs of that play in Los Angeles in 2015, one at the beginning of the year. And it was like bonkers. It's like practically sold out the whole run. And then we brought it back in the fall with a change I made to the beginning of the play because, when you're a playwright, you're watching your own play. You're like, you know what? This opening scene just doesn't cut it. The place is full. Like, everyone's going crazy. And you're like, I'm not happy with the first scene. And when it's your theater and your play, you get the chance to be like, what? I'm going to fix it.
Sure.
But that was an amazing experience and amazing to see the people who came out. People who I knew, and then a lot of people who I didn't know who were in at a much higher level than I was, or even worked in the Sea Org or worked for Miscavige. And the conversations I had after that play, sometimes for an hour or more, were really something else. Really something else. So,
I hope you do it again, Alan. I hope you do it again because I miss it.
And
I would
I'll send you the script. Yeah,
please, I'd love to read it.
Read it. Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
One of the fondest memories I have of Alan and shooting on the set was when we were doing the film TRs in Life, TR1.
Which is when we first met Alan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we shot all these vignettes throughout the entire film with different characters from different time periods and different walks of life. And at the end of the film, all of these people are sort of mystically conjured into this course room, a Scientology course room, where they're going to learn how to do these training routines so they can sort out whatever problems they had in their individual vignette. Right.
Yep.
And we and, had, there was, I just want to say, Mark, there was, we had the heavy hitters in terms of the cast.
Totally.
In that film, because we had Alan.
Sorry, I missed that last question you guys cut out. What was it?
We were saying who we had in that film. We had Jason Begay. We had
Larry Anderson.
Larry Anderson.
Carl Zamudia.
Marianne Elliott. Me.
There was all of the kind of heavyweight Scientology actors, Scientologist actors.
Were yeah, the whole gang was there.
Yeah, like, you know, if a jumbo jet would have hit that stage,
no more movies.
Yeah, Scientology yeah. film production would have been shut down yeah, for years.
Forever, yeah.
But when we got every when we had to get everybody back for this scene, there was so many. I want to say there was at least 15 or so different actors that we had to reunite.
Right.
And some of these people were on TV shows, or some of them actually were working actors. And it was hard to get all of them out to this Air Force base in the middle of the San Fernando Valley. San Bernardino.
It was way out there. It was like a full hour.
Yeah, it was literally Indian, you know, literally Native American Indian country.
Yeah.
And
there was no air conditioning.
Yeah, so that was
what I wanted. The actors were just pissed.
Yeah, so we're getting everybody there. It's at least 100 degrees inside the studio.
Yeah.
We have all these lights on, and
the makeup is melting.
Yeah, we can't turn on the air conditioning because it makes all this noise.
We brought in a portable, by the way. Alan said there was none, but we brought in one.
Yeah, no, I remember there was like a big, and we would all go near it and like.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. It was like this giant flexible hose that the actors would cluster around in between the scenes.
You could crawl into it. It was big enough that you could actually crawl in and cool down.
Yeah. But so I wanted to ask you, what was that like? From our end, it was just a giant cluster. It was a nightmare to work in that studio because it didn't have air conditioning. Sure. It was in the middle of nowhere. Right. We didn't have any kind of food services or craft services or anything.
But it was quiet.
Yeah, it was quiet.
No life within 10 miles.
But it also used
Not even a scorpion. Yeah, they were it's too hot.
They were dead. The scorpions in the restroom. I'm sure you found a couple.
The studio that we shot in used to be a nuclear bunker where they had that was like a secondary location after whatever's in the mountains in Colorado.
Well, yeah, it was built as a movie shooting studio, but it was built to withstand a nuclear attack because right outside the studio was a runway, and they used to transport jets, and not while we were there, but fighter jets. And so they built that studio so you could hear a pin drop while there was like an F-16 fighter taking off outside. So it was really so quiet in there. It was kind of scary. And we also believe it was the site where they filmed the alien autopsy, because we found evidence that had happened there.
There was a lot of freaky stuff in that place.
Yeah, really freaky. Yeah. But it was cheap and it was quiet.
Yeah, but I wanted to hear from Alan. What was your impression, and what was that like compared to going to other shoots and working with other crews?
Well, it was at the time, the conditions you described, we're all agreeing about the conditions. The first thing we remember, it was like ridiculous. But as an actor, and I was not like some big time Scientologist. I was like, Celebrity Center guy doing courses and stuff, but got sort of pulled into audition. I got this gig. But you had to get sec checked. You had to go through these clearances to work and to be hired. And it was like this big deal. And my father worked in the defense industry. And so there was kind of a hitch because it was like, what did he do and where did he work? And like all this. So there was this sort of big, hump I had to get over just to get onto the
But in all fairness, Alan, you also spoke fluent Russian, so even I was suspicious.
Okay. Yeah, so there is a little bit it's a little questionable there. One of the big commercials I got when I was still acting, I had to speak Russian in it, and it was shot out in that area too, somewhere. I remember my first day on the set, which was in LA, because my scene was I was a traveling salesperson and this hapless housewife.
Right.
She opens the door and I try to sell her something, and she has a crush on the salesperson. And it was my first day on any gold set. So I had no idea what this was. Were these people prissy? Was this like a solemn journey of a spiritual awareness? Like, what was the vibe? I was a little bit scared. My first day, I didn't know who Mitch was. He walks over. We do a little rehearsal. And Mitch walks over and gives Mariana Elliott, who's playing the housewife, the following direction. He says, just look at him like you want to F his brains out. Okay, like he opened the door and here's this guy, you just want to F his brains. And I laughed so hard because Mitch has got that very humorous way of delivering these things. And I went, oh, this is going to be fun. Like, the director's cool. And you were cool, Mark, and Sadie, and like all these people I remember, like were very cool, accessible, fun people. So when I read, when I read your book, Mark, and when I read Mitch recently, your book, to see the behind the scenes of the horror show under which you guys were working as an actor, you were really shielded from that. Yeah. At least I was. Like for me, working at Gold was a blast. Other than the drive and sometimes the conditions, you know, once we got to the new studio, it was lovely. But, you know, Norton was a shit show. But
to put it mildly,
the vibe that you guys created on the set, and I don't know if that came from Mitch. I don't know if it was just that particular crew at that particular time, late 90s, I think this was. It was honestly a lot of fun. There was a great camaraderie and an easygoing thing. And for the actors, it didn't feel rigid. It had the same, you know, the robotic arm from hell on that shoot. You know, I remember Jason Begay losing his shit because he was the one working professionally and he was making a special effort to get out there and he was fucking pissed and he's got that temper. And so it was tense because sometimes the actors were tense, but what you guys created was really a fun environment. I had a blast generally working for Gold. I looked forward to going out there mostly because of you two and Sadie and who was the camera guy?
John. Accident. John Gonzo. Yeah.
John Gonzalez.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is he still in?
Yeah.
Yeah. But a wonderful guy. I mean, and I don't know.
Yeah, really sweet guy.
Like
I don't know what he was behind the scenes.
He was a good guy.
That's what the experience was like, as an actor, for me at least.
Thanks for that, Alan. That's kind of, I think it was our intention to do that. You know, I've spoken with Sterling Tompkins. I don't know if you knew Sterling. He was a Sea Org member, a young kid, and I had him in a number of films, and he mentioned about how for a staff member at Gold, it was like being in the studio and being in a film was like an oasis because nobody could grab you out. You weren't going to get in any trouble during that time. But I just want to, I feel kind of obliged to say, because you did reveal the fact that I gave Marianna Elliott a kind of a obscene direction. I have to tell you, Marianna thanked me for that so much because it did help her to get to the absolute perfect
performance. And Marianna is totally cool. Like she's not someone who, this was late 90s. It was still,
I don't want them to think that I was using, you know.
Yeah. But even late 90s already is a generation enough that you're like, we spoke differently then. And there was a different attitude about how you spoke to people, but Marianna was totally cool with you. She loved you.
She did. No problem.
Yeah. No problem.
We did shoot a ton of things with Marianna as well.
Yeah.
She was in probably just about as many things as Alan was in.
Terrific actress.
Yeah.
I don't know what she's doing today, but she was, there were a few people that I felt that were good friends that I actually saw outside of that situation.
Yeah, she worked with me at the Playhouse for a long time. And then honestly, it was actually my play ended it because she was kind of ordered to from wherever, the ethics at CC or whoever.
Oh, she was still,
gave her a, you either quit that place or you can't do the courses or whatever she had.
Disconnect from you because you play. I
haven't seen her since.
Disconnection.
haven't seen her since.
She's still in Scientology.
I would think so, but on that level where she's been in for 25 or 30 years and still isn't clear, I don't know. But,
this is terrible.
It may just be. I think for a lot of people, it's just something that's comfortable that they do. It's a routine. It's I don't know. I don't want to get it. You guys know way more about.
Well, yeah, but
trip than I would,
still, but you do have a place to speak on that. I mean, I think of that as community and structure, which is important. Like a religious community, quite separate from the belief system, is an important thing. Any kind of community like that. So sometimes people, they just need that support in that community, which Scientology can't give you in some situations, not in the Sea Org. For sure.
Yeah. Well, there's that. What I found when I mean, I had been out for a number of years for various reasons, and it wasn't until whatever 2007, 2008. You know, Jason Begay did his videos, and then
the blogs
were starting to come out, and Rathbun, and you know, and I was like, huh, what? You know, I would be up until 3 or 4 in the morning, sometimes reading, could not believe. Because I had been there. Like when I read Mark's book, I was like, I was on set an hour before this hellacious, awful, abusive thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was sleeping or watching TV in the G's, the guest quarters, right, which were really quite nice. Lovely. Right. Service, you know, you had a service person come in and anything you need, blah, blah, blah. While Mark was running laps in the mud or whatever crazy shit. Like, yeah. I was flipping these pages. I couldn't believe that I was sitting there like, yeah, what a professional run set. Ooh, I'm having so much fun. And like, there was just abuse happening all around. Oh my God, what a journey. But for a guy at my level, going to CC was fun. There was fun people there. There was a piano in the lobby. I got to play it. I got to work in these films. I became kind of within that universe, a bit of a celebrity once those movies came out. Like you'd get talked to a certain way, or like, you know, you got that little taste of what it would be if you became a celebrity in the real world. So for me, it was honestly a lot of fun. I never had any difficult time other than production difficulties or fights between, I don't know if you guys were aware of, sometimes there'd be these epic fights between, was it Hillary? Who was the host?
Hillary.
Yeah.
I don't know, somewhere between her and up above her and Milton Katselis, who ran the Playhouse.
Yes.
There'd be these huge battles about me and my time. Because Milton would be like, I need him for a meeting. And if Milton needed you for a meeting.
Right, because you were, for those who don't know, you were an executive at the Beverly Hills Playhouse.
Yeah, like way up there. So if he needed me for a meeting, that was it. And I would be like, well, I'm supposed to go do a reshoot at Goal. He'd be like, no. He'd be like, no, you're not going. Tell him you can't go. And I'd be like, my boss says I can't go. And then there'd be this battle of like intention without reservation, like who can out-tone 40 or the other one, these battles. And I'd be sitting there going like, so sometimes, I don't know if you remember, I'd shoot until 2 o'clock and then come back for a meeting
and then go back
out and sleep overnight, shoot in the morning, go to the Playhouse for a meeting, you know, that would be the,
You've brought up two things here that I want to address. One, production difficulties. I want to get back to that.
Sure.
But you also brought up the Beverly Hills Playhouse, which a lot of people watching are not going to know. They're not going to know anything about. So maybe you could give us a little background on the Beverly Hills Playhouse, because it actually played a very important role in the Scientology community in Los Angeles.
Yeah, the Beverly Hills Playhouse is one of the big acting schools in Los Angeles. It's been around for now 40 some odd years, and it was founded by a guy named Milton Katselis, who was a very, very famous and legendary teaching.
We had a little internet clip.
Are you there?
Yeah, we're there. You glitched out for a moment.
There's occasional glitches on my end. I have a good signal, but it's glitching here and there. So Milton Katselis was a very, very famous acting teacher. He started the Beverly Hills Playhouse as a school. He was also a very well-known Scientologist. And really before the era of Tom Cruise, I think in Hollywood was considered one of the main opinion leaders, or one of the most foremost upstanding, like, I am a Scientologist. F yourself. He was out there up front.
He was personal friends with Hubbard. He knew Hubbard.
Yeah, there was a picture of the two of them. I remember it to this day on the ship. Behind Milton's desk, there was a picture of him and Ron on the ship. So very, very close ties to Jench and all the people who started CC. Very tight, very close relationship. And for a period there in the mid, late 90s, there was a tremendous flow of people back and forth, like Div 6 to the Playhouse, Playhouse to Div 6. There was this
it became a sales funnel. The Beverly Hills Playhouse was kind of known as a sales funnel for Scientology.
Yeah, but it wasn't in the classes. Like if you were to sit in a class, it really wasn't there that much.
Right. It was in the social structure. Yeah.
They were talking about PTS. It was more like just that within the structure of the classes, there were so many Scientologists who would do FSMing or would take you to an event or would, there was like all this sort of private coaching and FSMing going on. So there was a period there where there was a tremendous amount of synergy but even at that peak, that was maybe 15% of the students had anything to do with Scientology.
Right. Yeah.
It was just
a lot of big ones.
That's a lot of people. The school was huge.
Ann like Archer, Jason Legay. Elfman, Bodie Elfman, Catherine Bell. I mean, like big celebrities.
Jeffrey Tambor,
Giovanni Ribisi.
Yeah.
There was a moment there in the late 90s where all of these people were successful at the same time.
Scientologists and we're studying with Milton.
And we're studying at the Playhouse. So that's, I think, Mitch, when you wanted to sort of a reference point. And that carried all the way until about 2003, which is we're getting into the Tom Cruise era where this increased puritanical militant style of advocacy for Scientology kind of took hold. That pushed Milton away. He was not that kind of guy. Right. He had his own ethics in his personal life. He was a single Greek man, highly charismatic Greek man of a certain age, a certain era. They ran their lives a certain way on the 2D, as we say. So he would get in notorious trouble because he was such a horn dog. Let's face it. You know what I mean? He would just make passes left and center.
And they all tended to look the same. They were tall, skinny blondes. I mean, it was like, Milton had a type.
He had a type. And so as the Cruise kind of puritanical thing took over, Milton's old school style was pushed aside. And not only pushed aside, he became a target. And they, by 2003, 2004, he was being targeted for his ethics and his out 2D and the fact that he didn't progress on the bridge and he didn't give money and he didn't go to events. And he, his iconoclastic, like I am my own man style suddenly became in conflict with a new culture there. And that's what blew it off. That's what actually blew me out was not so much things that were happening to me, but the things that I observed happening with Milton that I felt were unjust, unfair, extreme. And I ended up being with him in meetings with like these high level ethics people at the AO confronting these like 50 page knowledge reports. You know, people would write knowledge reports is like just a mass, like they were crazy. So I would be kind of his, I don't know, consigliere in these meetings at AO. And I was watching these people go insane, crazy. Not that Milton was a prince, but the reaction was so extreme that it turned me off. And that was actually when I got out was long before I even wrote Disconnection or long before 2007, 2008, when the blogs and Marty and the people were starting to get out and tell people what was going on.
Yeah. I mean, I remember it got to the point where you were expected, if you were an actor, if you were expected to speak out against Milton, that where you could actually get points with ethics for impugning the Beverly Hills Playhouse, and then enter Grant Cardone, who turned it into a career, right?
Wasn't that sort of through Elena that happened?
Yeah.
Because Elena was an actress who was studying at the Beverly Hills Playhouse, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and like she, you know, there was like some interaction with her and Milton. I won't get into that. There was an interaction with her and Milton. I won't get into one way, two way, all that stuff. I don't you know what I mean?
That's where I started that fire with Grant.
I know some things about that. But that's what lit the whole Grant Cardone thing on fire. Grant wrote an email KR that he then blasted to like 1,000 people. You know, that was just the shitstorm of shitstorms.
Yeah. Eventually this place, the Beverly Hills Playhouse, it became this lightning rod for essentially.
And when I was at Gold, you guys probably knew I was being pulled into whatever ethics was in the studio. I was being pulled in and being grilled on Milton.
Right. Yeah.
So I would come off set and they'd be like, come here. And I'd sit down and be like, what's going on? And there'd be someone, Potter. What's her name? Potter, something Potter. Anyway. Yeah. And she would be like, what's going on with Milton's out ethics on his 2D? And I'd be like, I don't know. Like I'm just here shooting a movie. I'm not responsible for Milton's ethics on his 2D or what he's doing in his bedroom. Crazy. Like, and she goes, well, what's going on with Beverly Hills Playhouse? You know, like this very rigid thing that was pushing me away as well. This like that rigid prissy thing being pulled into ethics by like at CC, I'd be pulled in sometimes by like a 14-year-old ethics officer being questioned about the Playhouse, about Milton, about my allegiance to Milton and this, you know, and I just went like, you're 13. Like, what is going on? Like, that's when I start to be like, this is a
little like nuts. The Twilight Zone. You're just
for you people out there that are watching, you people never ends, whatever, you know, true crime watchers or whatever. What you're hearing about is the David Miscavige era of Scientology.
Yeah.
Like, this is 100% what is going on with this. So.
Yeah. I remember from the golden era and the talent, the people that dealt with the actors and actresses. That there was a guy, I think his name was Mark, and he worked at the Playhouse as like sort of an ethics officer within the Playhouse.
Mark McPherson.
Yeah. Right, Mark McPherson. And so he was getting parts and getting kind of, they were putting him into stuff because he was giving us information and he was sort of like the inside guy that was kind of giving us the real deal of what was going on. But then I remember when I was out and seeing like, oh no, that guy, you know, these people are still there and they're working. Are they, you know, who, what their allegiances were or whatever. I don't know after I left in 2005, but I do remember that it was just a big mess. And even if we got somebody, if they had been at the Playhouse, it was then where it used to be like a good thing. It was like, oh no, we can't use that person because they're connected to the play. Right. So it kind of was turning into this thing. Yeah, and there
went all 99% of all the good actors I had to work with. It was really tragic.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you'd have to reshoot, right? If like,
somebody did something stupid, like wrote a play, put on a play called Disconnection.
That was, fuck.
I have to reshoot. Well,
like, I'd be curious, like, when did I become, like, because I think I was declared somewhere, I don't know, 13, 14, 15, something like that. I never really, of course, I never got copied. You find out because everyone's dumping you on Facebook or something, you know, but was there a time where at some point they were like, okay, we got to reshoot the Dianetics thing that like, this guy Alan became a,
I don't remember.
I was going to say.
One is a big reshoot.
Yeah, we did that. I want to bring up this picture real quick, Mitch. I'll bring this up. We did a film called TR16 Beingness. Yeah. And in this film, we had not only these four, which is Jason Begay, Alan Barton there up on the upper right, and then Jeff Pomerantz, who does all the voiceovers for us. Scientology different productions, the intros.
Well, he does all the events, if you've ever heard that crazy, like, are you ready to rumble? It sounds like the Las Vegas wrestling guy.
Yes.
That would be him.
And then Larry Anderson is there, the last one in the picture. Right. But you also had in this film, we had Tate Rupert. We had Jim Meskimen,
Tamara Meskimen. Oh, my God, these names.
We have Odie Elfman,
Carla Zamudio. We had a whole – we basically had the who's who of the Scientology actors that had been in other films.
Well, it had a huge cast.
Yeah, we had it in this film as well, in this TR16 film. But the film – the thing that you were just talking about with the Dianetics video, we shot a project called the – it was going to be a Dianetics – they called it a docu-mercial because they didn't want to be – they didn't want to be lumped in with the infomercial.
Yeah, because I had pointed out to David Miscavige, I didn't want to do an infomercial because I thought it was bad positioning for Scientology. And I said, you tell me one premium product – in existence on planet Earth that has ever done an infomercial. And you tell me all the products that you really love and admire, not one of them ever did an infomercial. And so he said, okay, we're going to do a docu-mercial.
So it's just an infomercial that's called a docu-mercial, like a documentary and a commercial. But regardless, we shot that. And the host, the narrator of that project was Grant Cardone.
No.
On camera commentator. That's how we met Grant.
Yeah. Grant got involved with all of this was.
Yeah. That's how he met Elena. She was cast in a film.
That's where they met.
Yeah. 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 We were downtown LA, midnight. We were she was in a little vignette. I was sitting in the trailer with Grant. She came walking in to check in with talent. Talent wasn't in there. So she walked up, introduced herself to me. I recognized her. She didn't know me, but I cast her from my headshot because she didn't have any lines. She just had to slap a dude and walk away. Remember, we shot that kind of shit all the time. Just slap him, you know, it's for Dianetics. And so Grant went like monosyllabic when he saw her. He was like, And then he said to me, you have to introduce me to her. And I'm like, I'm not going to pimp for you. She's on the set. Go introduce yourself. So anyway, that's how that whole thing happened.
Wow. So, but, but So we shot that whole thing, and David Miscavige didn't want to use Grant. We had to basically sell him on using Grant. And then we shot the whole thing. And with him, we shot all these different where he just narrates and introduces a scene. And one of those was the session where we show how to do this session. Now, right. The actress who came to be in that session was a two shot, or it was just two actors, yeah. This girl. And then
Ted and Cher facing each other.
Yeah, and they had to do a Dianetics auditing session. Well, that girl had been up all night with Grant the night before.
And it was Grant?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And boy, I didn't know it was Grant.
Yeah,
he was bragging about it in the morning when he came into the lounge, in the talent lounge in the castle. He was like,
"That's perfect."
He was like, "Oh, I had to use up a whole bottle of Viagra," and he's telling all this stuff, and we're just like, "Are you an insane person? Like, we have to."
And shoot. That's the guy who writes a KR on Milton.
Yes, yeah. And we had to shoot.
Well, he wasn't married yet, but that's whatever. But yeah,
but he was. But because we had to shoot with her, she literally didn't know any of her lines. And to me, it was kind of wild because Alan would do his lines and then he would do her lines and then she would just parrot back her lines to Alan. Yeah, so we had to, we cut around everything, but Alan just from memory. This part to me was you went up so many levels as an actor to be Alan because you did all of your lines.
I remember the crew,
her lines.
That was like a day where the crew, I earned a certain level of respect with the crew. I remember I got along with everyone, but saving that shoot on that day by doing her lines.
Because the thing at Gold,
figuring out a way to.
Yeah, so the thing at Gold, this actress, who, by the way, I had gotten her into Scientology, and she used to work for me. She was a really good friend of mine. She had been one of the girls that was brought into audition as Tom Cruise's potential girlfriend, and blah, blah, blah. And I never knew about this. I thought, oh, poor girl. You know, sometimes this happens to an actor, right, Alan? They're just having the worst day, and they can't remember anything. And I thought, oh, I've got to help her out. What am I going to do? Plus, at Gold, everybody gets in trouble. We can't get through that day, if we can't figure out a way to solve it, they're not going to blame it on her. They're going to blame it on everybody. And they're going to blame it a lot on Mark because he's running the group. So he's really going to get it big time. So that's we had to come up.
I just remember Alan saving my ass that day. He did all of her lines. I was like, this guy's our secret Alan, we're going to do this.
So we handed him the script and like read her line. So he would say, hello, how are you? How are you doing today? How's it going? And she would say, hello, how are you? How are you doing today? How's it going? And he would say, fine. And then we would cut it together. It was great. So
you couldn't tell that's how that was put together at all.
No, it was amazing.
But in the end, none of that footage, none of that stuff ever became a project. And
we never got released. Well, but just for clarification, just to be historically accurate about this, everything we shot with Grant was thrown out. All the other stuff was then incorporated into other projects.
Everything we used all of that footage in B-roll or it could work.
Yeah.
But the Grant footage never, ever saw the light.
Not for anything.
Yeah, and somewhere there is a whole thing of Grant being the front guy for Scientology and Dianetics and being this thing. And the craziest part of it is that David Miscavige didn't like him because he came off as like a swarmy.
Yeah, he's just swarmy,
like a used car salesman.
Like a thug, kind of a thug. Yeah, so. the amazing thing is, not long before I left Scientology, I was at Scientology Media Productions, and I got a letter from David Miscavige. And he said that, okay, so I did this thing with a writer, this woman that used to work with us, and she and I wrote this thing, right? She was with us on the set all the time when we were shooting Grant. She had a massive crush on Grant, right? And it was kind of silly. But so apparently Grant had gone to Miscavige years later and said he'd warned the writer, this woman, that it wasn't going to work and that we were just like kidding ourselves. He lied to him. This was a total fiction. Like he never told her that because he was never with her when I wasn't there. Because we were always on the set together. So to ingratiate himself with Miscavige, he told this lie about, well, you know, the thing I told the writer that it wasn't going to work. And then I know that Miscavige believed it because he wrote me and said, the person's name. You know, she, Grant told me that he warned her that that wasn't going to work. And I would, anyway, fortunately, yeah. this it was towards the my final days there, and it, there was so much crap going on. That, but yeah, so anyway, that's our. Somehow we managed to work in a Grant Cardone story. But.
Yeah.
yeah. Well, because he crossed so many different paths.
Well, yeah. And with yeah. the Playhouse, he really was a villainous talk to oh, character. Man. He was the worst. Yeah. And he was doing it also just to ingratiate himself, to make himself look good. He was just going to tear these yeah. people apart, which is, you know,
yeah. serve Milton on a platter for a
mistake. Yeah. Yeah. His own yeah. psychopathic, narcissistic gain. It was just. Not a good guy.
Yeah.
The other shoot I wanted to ask you about, Alan, was we did a what we called it was a trailer for one of these films. Oh. And we shot it on Hollywood Boulevard, right where they Scientology has the Hollywood Test Center, the big building yeah. right near Hollywood and Highland yeah. that's got the Scientology sign down the side mm-hmm. of it. And it was a trailer for the film PC Indicators. And right. what was supposed to happen is there's supposed to be this gunman.
Oh, man.
Who's yeah. up in the building, and he's either got hostages or he's – I don't remember yeah. the premise, but he's got a gun and he's shooting at everybody. And there's
not just a gun. He's got
an AK.
An AK-47. He's got a machine gun.
I don't think we're supposed to say that word. We say pew-pew.
Pew-pew, right. He's got a pew-pew.
And
a Russian-designed pew-pew.
And he's supposed to shoot at a bunch of the cop cars, and we had like pyros, squibs, you know, to make the bullets fire and all this other stuff. But we were supposed to do this starting like right when it got dark. And of course, in true Golden Era Shoot Crew style, we weren't mm-hmm. exactly ready at that time.
No. I was like, it was midnight, 1 a.m.
I want to say, yeah, we were shooting off these pew-pews, these fully automatic pew-pews in the middle of the night with blanks. Mm-hmm. I remember it being very loud. But what were you in that scene? You were like a reporter?
Or? I was a reporter or someone who didn't understand what was going on. So someone comes up, like the Scientologist or the person who knows about indicators. Like says something. I just remember because this was the audition. Like, yeah, you got to look at the guy's skin tone. And my response was like, skin tone.
Yeah.
Like,
so
what the F are you talking about? You know. And that was the audition. Was skin tone. You know. Yeah. And for years after that, like people would come up to me at CC and be like, skin tone.
There you go.
You know. Yeah. Like it was just one of yeah. those readings
yeah.
that you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, remember. I think the setup was there was a hostage negotiator
yeah.
that was using Scientology technology to try to evaluate the guy's emotional state.
Exactly.
And so they could talk him down. Of course, the whole thing goes horribly bad. And you were the kind
so
of
I was the lead police. Hostage negotiator, and some guy who yeah. knows about PC indicators is talking to me and saying, right. no, you got to look at the guy's skin tone. I'm like, what?
Oh my goodness.
That was an early gig for me too. That was like one of the like second or third or something like that. I was still sort of getting my sea legs on what the vibe was.
Yeah. One of the other reasons why I remember that, because it was a night shoot and we would set up during the day and then we would shoot at night and then we would sleep in Los Angeles. And then the next day we'd drive back up to the desert to Golden Era Productions.
Right.
And one of the crew was in trouble. He was a camera guy and he had gotten in trouble because some shot was out of focus or something happened or it was a bad camera move. And he was supposed to get interrogated at Gold. So he told us in the morning, he said, hey, I got to go back to Gold to go get interrogated. And there's a special shuttle that'll to take people like at times. So then we were setting up for the shoot and then we shot all night. And then the next morning, somebody said, hey, blah, 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 needs to come to get sec checked right after you guys are done with the shoot. We're like, he went yesterday to do that. And then we were like, uh-oh, he got a 24-hour head start. He gone.
And no, he's halfway to the Arizona border.
And no one has ever heard from that guy ever. Yeah. He literally disappeared into the ether. And I've asked people about him, you know, since I left in 2005. But yeah, no. So whenever we did that shoot, we lost somebody. And then that ended up, you know, then we had to all kinds of other nonsense happens when one of the crew kind of escapes during a location. Yeah, shoot,
who gets busted for the fact that an escape happened? Is that you or?
Well, that one.
No, I would not get in trouble.
Mitch, Because you were never like Seahawk, right?
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is they're not going to yank me into ethics because that means they have to shut shooting down.
Yeah.
So, you know, they can get another cameraman or whatever, but yeah. I was the only guy who could run the crew, direct a set. So it was like, I could get away with a lot, and I did. So.
I'm pretty sure I'm the one who got in trouble for that. Yeah. Because I was over grip, lighting, and camera were my direct Sea Org members that I was responsible for, even though I was also responsible for makeup and costume and props and everything else. But the organizationally, grips, camera, and lighting were directly under me. So if a camera person escaped.
Yeah, he was your guy, Mark. Yeah. And you should have seen it coming. God damn it. You should have seen it coming.
I know. I didn't. You know what I didn't see? I didn't see the indicators. That's
what
exactly. You didn't see his skin tone.
I couldn't tell what his skin tone was.
Mark. Skin tone.
He was.
Well, you know, Alex, since you mentioned the I guess buzz phrase, that is a thing. The catchphrase, I guess, the catchphrase for you from that ad was skin tone, right? And it became like a catchphrase. Yeah. People would come up to you and they'd say it. That's one of the things that Mark and I have been discussing on the show is the number of catchphrases within Scientology that came out of these films. You know, like I duplicated utterly. Mark did one. He came in a room. He said, wrong room. People would do that all the time. There's a bunch of them. But you also had another one in that Being this film. And I'm trying to remember what it
was. Was it the four?
Yeah, the four. Yeah, it was with the. Yeah, yeah, do you remember?
Could I just that? Have. What is it? Two more days, you know, like, like, because he's always wanting more time, if I remember. Yeah, and I would be like, I need. Just one more day. Just one more. Yeah, you know, like he was so neurotic. He was so overwhelmed.
Yeah.
That was like a big deal getting that. I remember reading like LRH advices or whatever they called them, like pages of him talking about this character that they couldn't cast at the time he was making these movies.
Well,
that's another key thing. We should bring that up in that TR-16 Being this film. L. Ron Hubbard is coaching these people on how.
Yeah.
You're supposed to do
this. I had to have scenes with him.
Yeah, and so we had a
Not with him, but we had a
voice.
Yeah, we had a body actor that we shot from behind because that's what Hubbard instructed to do. Stupidest thing in the world. And then we had a voice. We were never supposed to say impersonator. We were supposed to say, and then we had an actor portray his voice. It was a portrayal because obviously, as any actor knows, there's a difference between an impersonation and a portrayal. So so anyway, but basically we did the best we could to impersonate L. Ron Hubbard from behind.
And just as another callback, the guy that we used most of the time to do the body double
back then,
L. Ron Hubbard back then, was the guy that blew on that shoot in Los Angeles.
That's right. So on this film, we had to get an outside
guy. Film, we had a real big guy that really matched L. Ron Hubbard exactly.
Yeah, like, they dyed his hair.
We had to do all these hair tests to send him a scavenge of the back of this guy's, like the moles on his neck and his hair and his ears. And they were forensically comparing those
to
L. Ron Hubbard's head.
Yeah, and he was really concerned, remember, Mark, with... Hubbard apparently had very thick wrists and long, long, skinny fingers. So this was like, whoa, this is a big deal. Nope, fingers are too short. Nope, wrists are too thin. No, it was just... It was
never ending to find a guy who matched L. Ron Hubbard from back. So, and he didn't, all he did was move. That's it. He would do like, there was hand movements and then there was head shakes and there was nods.
Yeah.
And that was really it. And it was like, this is the hardest part is just getting something to look like him. Not even the other stuff. And pretty much anybody we get can do it.
Yeah. I don't know if it's worth talking about the actual concept of that film, but it's based on a true story that Hubbard had actually himself trained all of these auditors up to a certain level, and they all were horrible. And so his solution for that was to explain to them that maybe it was their attitude, that maybe when they were auditing, they had the wrong attitude, and maybe they needed to take a little bit of time and think about their attitude and think about what and who they were trying to be. It's really a mind fuck kind of a thing.
Totally.
And so a messenger had recorded this lecture in real life, and then Hubbard took it and he wrote it into this fictionalized version. And it's a crazy film. It's just because he just gaslit all these people into thinking the reason that his ridiculous technology didn't work was because they had the wrong attitude.
We just had the wrong attitude.
Yeah. So
I remember that being a very large scale film. Like it wasn't that like sort of like to finally shoot TR-16 was like
big deal.
It was a huge deal.
Big deal.
I think it was also one of the last few ones that had never, ever been shot. Yeah,
never been done.
Maybe that's it. Maybe that's – I remember there was something about it. It was like
one of the maybe that was the one that we completed. Yeah, we completed the tech films the first time we completed them.
And that's then we all got it was also the last one that had to be done. It was that we did all of them. When we finished that one, they were all done for the very first time in history, even though they'd all be multiple times get redone. But like that one, they got
they gave you a week off and sent you to a nice
No, they gave us Letterman jackets and patches
that they kept for me when I escaped. They said, no, we're not giving you that jacket.
That film you only get to see at a very high level, and I wasn't even at the level to see the film. And I remember I think I got to see it on the ship. I was down there for something
and
I got to see it there, like in a small room, and it was me and Jeff. And we got to, they sort of snuck one by because technically I wasn't at high enough level to see the movie that I'd just been in. Yeah. Like, I know the movie, guys. I was in it. I remember there being an issue about whether I could see the movie. I just acted the whole thing.
It makes no sense. There's a lot of strange, weird stuff like that. So.
Yeah.
What was the movie we did where it was a kitchen setup and things were falling apart in the kitchen?
Oh, that was with
Marianna.
That was with Marianna as well.
With Marianna. When we did Start Changing.
Oh, yes, we covered
that. Like when I'd go to the refrigerator and the handle came off.
Yes.
I shot that film three times. I did. It was the first film I did when I went to Gold. Then I shot it again with you. And then after you left, I shot it again with Jack Armstrong. Jack, remember Jack?
His name. Yeah,
I shot it with Jack Armstrong, and I forget who played his. Anyway, I wrote about that film because it was quintessentially, the script contained Hubbard's really misogynistic view of women's role in society. Yeah. It really was, you know, this woman, she was accident prone, she was like ditzy, and she wasn't fulfilling her role of taking care of the man. And this is kind of subtle in the film. Like, I didn't even realize that when I was making it, how much it was based on his sort of very 50s misogynistic view of a woman's role in life was basically to care for a household, which is something he had written about. And that, you know, when a society fails to do that, they're on their way out and blah, blah, blah. So we made a whole film about, yeah, maybe I'm confused. I don't know, but it was you were
did
in
Marianna Elliott do it twice.
I guess she was, because the time I did it with Jack was with Marianna Elliott.
Yeah,
she did a role again.
Yeah,
but the new me.
Yeah, exactly. No, but wait a minute. But you played the role of the husband, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you were the husband. So, but you weren't in the one with Jack Armstrong. He was the auditor.
Oh, was he the auditor?
Jack was the
auditor. We're all we're like three different things. It turns out.
Yeah, no, but maybe I only shot it twice then. Maybe because the second time you were the husband who called the auditor. Jack was the auditor. Marianna was the
recruiter. Yeah,
reminds me of a joke. You want to be the husband or you want to be the wife?
Yeah.
Okay, so we did that film. What was another one that we did? Because I remember shooting. Did you ever shoot at those studios in Hollywood where we were doing E-meter films? Did you ever do any of that? Were you around during that? Was like early. That was like mid-90s. Like
That was actually when Jason came in.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we first met Jason in Hollywood. You know, we're in Sunland. We were in someplace, and he was.
But at least he got to shoot like studio.
That was like I shot something at AO with you guys, but a ton of teasers, like stuff for the events.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like I feel like half the stuff I shot for you was like a teaser for the events. that they were still fun. But I remember Mitch, you and I going to get Mexican food up on Hollywood Boulevard because there was some problem with the setup, or they weren't ready, and you were just like, "Come on, man, let's go eat." And I was like, "Huh? The director is asking me to go eat." You know,
that was a move that Mitch would do. I always thought he was doing that to shield the actors from the horrible food that we were going to possibly get.
Well, I was,
and so he would be like, "Hey, let's go grab it." And it was always if there was chips and salsa within 100 feet of Mitch.
Yeah, I would find
it. Like a little radar that goes off.
So yeah, I would absolutely find. I am a true Angeleno, not born here, but raised here. So
the food went up when you got to the castle. They seem to remember the food quality.
Oh yeah.
When we were at Norton, we had to get whatever food they'd make the food the night before, and they'd put it in these like metal trays. And then when we'd leave in the morning, we'd grab it. Yeah, we'd just grab it and bring it out there. And it was sort of like, it was a surprise what we were going to get. And most of the time, it was what I used to affectionately call rainbow beef and sweaty cheese, because it had been sitting in these things for, 12 hours by the time it would get to lunchtime or whatever it was. And so to me that was always my most embarrassing sort of aspect of shooting with people outside of the bubble. Like sometimes we'd get Scientology actors and that would be horrible, but sometimes we'd get just actors that didn't know anything about Scientology, and I would always think this is the worst representation of these people have all this money, but they're going to spend $80 on lunch for somebody. That's for sure.
Yeah. And also there was the motorhome issue. We would go on location and they wouldn't necessarily provide, this is when I, coined the term of, Starbucks, America's de facto restroom. But I don't know if you remember.
Well, issue with SAG too. Remember, the big moment of like, was Golden Era gonna do a SAG contract? I seem to remember that was being a fairly significant
we're
really gonna get paid.
That was a real problem because you remember what's her name, Shauna Brakefield, right? Did you knew Shauna? She was married to Tate Rupert. Did you ever know
her? Yeah, I knew Tate well, knew her someone.
She's not there, haven't been married in years, and she's no longer hasn't been a Scientology for years. As a matter of fact, she testified on behalf of Paul Haggis.
Tate still in?
I don't know. I'm not hearing from him.
He was such a good guy, and I'm sure he still is. I say was because these people are like from another chapter in my life. But
I don't know. He's back east because his wife, his ex-wife and his daughter moved back there, and he wanted to be close to them. I know he was struggling financially and painting houses and stuff, which is kind of a shame because he's a good actor. But Shauna was in charge of – she used to work for SAG. She was a Scientologist who worked for SAG, and she used to work for the indie department, the part of SAG that is trying to make deals with independent filmmakers. Like, so at least they can capture that. They can work with that sector, right?
Yeah.
So we worked with Shauna, and she actually did this deal, which is how Gold could be a signatory. They could hire SAG actors, but they could mix the SAG actors with staff members who were extras, extras, not speaking parts, because the idea was that those Scientology staff members are not taking work away from anybody in the guild. And then, of course, they could always do independent work, which we mostly tried to do. But sometimes we would do a SAG contract because, it's like when I redid the film Jason was in, I had to spend a lot of money to get decent actors. We were going up into the thousands of dollars a day, kind of fee for people. Because they learned the lesson that, you pay peanuts, you get monkeys.
Didn't it evolve to a certain point, Mitch, though, where they weren't using Scientologists as actors at all? And you were only using non-Scientologists because you kept having to redo things because every Scientologist would be declared.
That was an amazing sort of a circuitous bit of logic that they got to the point of having to not use Scientologists because if the Scientologists left, they'd have to reshoot because God forbid you see a person on up there who maybe is not. As if someone viewing the thing would know or not know, but
They would. I think they would have known who Jason Begay was.
I guess within, yes.
But even more, I think even more cogently is the idea that we're going to clear the planet, except for enough people to be in our films.
Yes,
we don't want Scientologists in our film, so we're always going to leave enough people out there. Just, you know, just such.
I want to ask you guys about, because in your book, sure, Mitch, I was so astonished, and I can't remember if it's in yours as well, Mark, and maybe it is, and I can't remember. Forgive me, but Lisa.
Oh yeah, I wrote about
Lisa. I remember that was the biggest, one of the big shocks to me, because on set, I remember liking her a lot when she was your assistant, Mitch, or your first AD. She seemed like as genuine as Mark or Sadie or John or like any of these people, like the makeup people, there was the Southeast Asian one and then the redhead and like all these
persons. Sarney and Sam.
Who were so great. I really, really enjoyed them. And Lisa was one of them.
Yeah. Well, they had, they were all happy. They had a great, they had the best jobs in the Sea Org. I don't know.
But it was, that was the most astonishing.
Yeah, Lisa.
See that Lisa was the sort of the monster that you clearly portray, and I'm sure is an accurate portrayal. But that one, well, I was like, whoa!
I can tell you that Mike Render read my book, and he graciously also did some fact checking on the manuscript. And one of the notes I got back from him was, "You nailed Lisa." So,
the description of Lisa is the most comprehensive description of this person that you could have and easily.
Yeah, but to answer your question, Alan, it was, she hadn't, Miscavige hadn't fully gotten a hold of her and turned her into a monster, because he has a way of doing this. I mean, she went from being my assistant, not an assistant AD, but director's assistant, to being the commanding officer of Golden Era Productions, and to working as a protege of David Miscavige, and who eventually then threw her in the hole. You know, you've all heard the horrible story about being Debbie Cook being put in a barrel of ice water and having a sign put on her that says Lesbo. Well, that would have been Lisa who hung the sign around her neck. So,
like, you know, that's just,
yeah, I know.
It's wild.
I can't conceive that this cool person who would like give me smokes, and we'd, you know, because you and, and her would like go have a smoke on a break.
Yeah.
Like all the time. Like there's probably 100 cigarettes.
She was funny. She was funny, but she was in a great spot then, because she'd been busted up, and she was what, Mark? She was the.
She was in charge of
CMO, and she was.
Yeah, no, she was in charge of ethics in CMO.
Yeah,
she was over the HCO, which is like the
ethics. Yeah, she was like an HCO chief CMO.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she'd been the receptionist in CMO, blah, blah. Then she got busted. And then when I was overworked, I needed assistance. So they somehow, her handling, they, you know, I don't know. Got so much of the trash, but
in the C organization at the Int base, Golden Era Productions is the lowest you can be. So
I was literally about to make that point. Was that's something that I learned after the fact, because as an actor coming in and you get the clearances and you get the directions and can you go and the thing and then this and then that, you feel as though you're like at the top, man. Yes. Like they're like right across the street there.
You're at the bottom of
all happening. The studio and the thing and the musicians and the, you know, you're at the top of the, I mean, you know, and then afterwards to read the books and you go like, Gold was like, kick him to the trash.
For Miscavige, the ultimate is for you, if you're a high up executive and now you're the assistant to the director on the shoot
team.
A lot of those guys, if they were males, they would have been put in the grounds department as a de-weeder. But if we have a person that could be this assistant person who's personable and she could interact with Mitch, it's still a punishment though, because of she was to be that.
Right, but wouldn't you say, Mark? But wouldn't you say that if a toilet backs up at Gold, or if a sprinkler breaks, or if you need a light bulb or a fuse change, you've got to call an engineer from Gold. You call Gold because Gold supplied all the support services for the whole base, including food, including lodging. Like they were responsible for all that. But the shoot crew, I mean, Miscavige spent millions on that castle and lavished us with equipment as long as we were producing lots of work. The shoot crew was its own rarefied bubble.
That's
like,
true.
You're feeling that, Alan. You're feeling like you hit the top. You know, you were at the top. In that environment, it was, right? Because
We were David Miscavige's pet project. So
that's definitely the vibe I got.
Yeah, because I didn't call anybody from CMO Int or RTC sir. I wasn't expected to. I didn't even call Miscavige sir. Because it made me feel uncomfortable. I'm like, why am I calling this guy sir? It's like weird. You know, I just like whatever. So, but whatever. But I think that's it. Yeah, but it is very much outside. Once you set outside the castle, that's the like. That's like you're at Harvard, and then that's the janitorial department.
That's a funny thing that you mentioned that, Mitch, because the castle was so far away from everything else.
Right.
People wouldn't go there from if out on the property. Like if you didn't work there, there'd be no reason.
Yeah, that's true.
So we just kind of got left alone just based on the location. It was just too far to go.
Yeah, too far to give you shit.
Reason. Yeah.
Yeah, we were like 800 yards away from the closest facility there. So yeah, it was pretty far.
And the other thing was, is if David Miscavige did go to the castle, which he did on a pretty regular basis, if he was at the property, he wanted to see what was going on over there.
I met him there a couple times.
Yeah. So if you were at the castle and you weren't supposed to be, and he was there, you were toast. Like you could be in really big trouble. Yeah. So it was sort of like we had a little force field, but at the same time, David Miscavige was in there with us. So we were protected from the rest of the property, but not him. So, you know, it was all sorts of nonsense. And the funniest thing is even after we built that place, that's where we packaged almost all of the Scientology basic books and compact discs.
Well, I remember shooting there. Maybe it was on TR-16 when every hallway,
yes.
Which I think the circumference of the castle is like a mile.
Probably.
You know,
all those tables. I got to tell you this. You might be the first person that's been out in the wild who's ever seen that, because that was how David Miscavige was justifying that all of the L. Ron Hubbard policies and all of the L. Ron Hubbard bulletins are not right. Because they're out of order and there's things that shouldn't be. And so they could never, ever look at everything. And so he had this bright idea. Why don't you print out every single thing that L. Ron Hubbard ever wrote and put it in order? And they kept trying to do it.
And it took the circumference of the castle to do it.
Like, actually, it wasn't big enough. That whole thing is a move, right? To a warehouse that looks like the ending of Indiana Jones, the original one.
Yeah.
Literally, it's in a warehouse.
Men.
Yeah, and the thing is that Miscavige has this delusion that if he lays out in date order everything that Hubbard ever did, he'll be able to figure out the sort of magic key that will make it all work. And it's never going to work.
Like why it hasn't worked yet.
Yeah, because what Hubbard wrote was just...
They're always finding some key piece of information that's unlocking everything.
I remember very early on, you know, again, I got in because, I mean, I found a lot of his stuff legitimately interesting. And I have the kind of brain that'll read a 1,000-page book like Dianetics or, you know, the tone scale thing. And, you know, but I remember early on at one of the events, like I would go to the CC events. Yeah. 10X, 12X, 20X, 30X, you know, and then I'd be there the next year. And I remember asking someone, I got like a really evil look. I forget who I asked, staff member, somebody. And I was like, but if it was 20X last year and it's 30X this year, the parking lot, you need a new parking lot. You need like 5 new parking lots.
Right.
Like that doesn't make any sense to me. I was saying that in like 1998. I was like, I was here last year and it said 10X.
Yeah.
And this year it's 20X.
The cognitive dissonance has to be very strong to keep you in
where that. Where are all those people?
It's never 10X where you are, Alan.
Yeah. It's somewhere else.
It's 10X in Tanzania.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And a lot of times it literally would be in an organization. They got one person clear last year.
Yeah.
And this year they got 10 people clear. So it's 10X, but they don't say, well, yeah, but it was not even really one, because that guy that got cleared, he was already cleared before. He just was, somebody told him it wasn't. And then he was
he's got a retread. That's like, everyone do their student hat. Again, it's new stats. Look at the stats.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, they lost a lot of people on that whole routine, making them do stuff over. But it's amazing the people they did lose. I mean, it's like one particular person I'm thinking of who happens to be married to Jim Meskimen. She was on Solenauts longer than anybody I knew, maybe 10 years. And she did every iteration of it. Just when it would finish, the new one would come out.
They would come out a new one.
Just when it would finish, and she some people, they just persevere. They're so hardwired into that community and that ideology. And, you know, and the thing is, you have paid to have it, to accept a false identity for yourself. I mean, that's a pretty serious thing. You know, the fact that you're a spiritual being, that you lived for all these years, that you were in this cataclysmic, you know, cosmic galactic disaster, and that you're infested with body thetans and all this stuff. You've accepted this over time as your identity. So in order to change that, and the more of that you do, and you've also paid for it. So
yeah, the sunk cost.
That is big, but it's also, it's this idea that you really don't know who you are. I mean, I struggled with this because you've so accepted this fictional identity, and you know, your story of who you are, that's the most important thing you have. And so you've now paid money to have this fake one. And when you, it can be really devastating to say, I know that's bullshit, but who the hell am I? I mean, it's like, I struggle. I had a lot of issues with that. So
when you were talking about earlier, you saw this and this was kind of the thing. And was there one thing, if you could isolate that, or just one piece of information or a story or something that kind of pushed you over the edge? Like, what was that thing that you just said? Yeah, for you, Alan, that you were like, I'm not going to be in this anymore. Like, what
the, I want to make sure I'm not glitching. Are you there?
Yeah,
we're good.
Okay, cool. I saw you. I got the spinning wheel. What did it for me was this jihad against Milton in the school. Because he was a teacher, mentor, a friend, depending on the day, given that there's 4 years difference between us and all that. Yeah, but yeah. I was the guy really helping him run the school by that time. I was fairly high up in the management. And it was the way they were treating him and these insane... I remember a big moment for me was the famous Tom Cruise meritorious giganticus whatever award he got, and that speech he gave, which became very famous. I didn't go to that event, but then I watched it later, and I remember thinking there was sort of this thing of like, you either get on the train or you whatever it was.
You're either on the team.
And I remember
or
telling
not.
Someone at the Playhouse. I can't remember. I said I watched that event, and I said I'm going to get off your train because I don't like you. And I don't like your attitude and I don't like the vibe. So I'm getting off the train. But Milton, you know, but I did it quietly because Milton was still in. Mm-hmm. He was still seeking a connection with Cece. I think he was personally hurt by the people who were coming after him and losing Jenna Elfman, who I think he felt a real kinship to as a student and someone who became successful under his guidance. And I was my allegiance was really first to him and to the school, and Scientology was way down on the list. And I had met my wife of 20 years, but we were dating back then. And she was raising some flags that at the time I was like, oh my God, is this a problem? Is this a person for me? I don't know. Should I find someone else? Should I be on? But it was more like she was kind of like that person that I was in a certain way going, but if it was 10X last year, 20X this year, how come the parking lot's empty?
Right.
She would ask that question and I'd get ornery about something else. Mm-hmm. But I was smart enough to be listening. And so all those things kind of led me to be like, you know what? I think I'm done with this. There was a demand at one point that there were these two students, brother and sister, Mangiello, something. And their mother was declared. And she was a woman who would show up at events with placards, like Scientology is bad. And they were students at the school. And we got pulled in, or I got pulled in on behalf of Milton to be given an order that these two kids had to be thrown out of the Beverly Hills Playhouse. Because their mother held up a sign at an event, and if we didn't throw these two kids who were perfectly good students of ours, if we didn't throw them out of the school because of their connection to their mother, because they wouldn't disconnect from her and we had to disconnect from them, then they would disallow every other Scientologist at the school from doing anything in Scientology, down to CC. All those people would be kicked off their kickoff lines or whatever you could call it, because the Playhouse didn't sever its connection to two young kids whose mom was, I just went, no, this is wrong. It just finally hit that moment for me. And this is probably 2001, 2002, where I just went, I'm done. I can't do this. Wow. But it was another 10 years before they messed. Do you remember Mario Pfenniger?
Yes, I was going to say. Well, yeah.
This became the story that, of my play,
yeah,
which is that he was my piano teacher, and he was a very tolerant, genial man. Mm. Didn't care that I was in, out, was willing to talk about anything. Very old school, old and old school. But he was always in financial straits, and I was helping him out. I was just helping him pay his bills. You know, he was 90 something years old. He needed help. And at some point they told him that he had to return those checks from me because I was still affiliated with the Playhouse or Milton or whatever. And that was the one that turned me from kind of passively inactive to, okay, fuckers. Now you're going to hear from me.
Yeah.
And that's when I got in contact with Marty Rathbun, because he had posted something about Milton and that whole story. And I was like, I know all about that.
Yeah.
And this happened. And then this happened. And then this happened. And that whole thing with Mario, when he told me that he was pulled in by ethics and could no longer, not only not accept my help, could no longer see me as a student or as a friend because of the, that just pissed me off so bad.
Yeah.
And that, but I remember driving around going, that's actually a good idea for a play. How poignant is that to interfere with a teacher-student relationship, which is a very strong relationship when you've got the right combo. It's very powerful.
Yeah, especially when you're talking about something like music.
Yeah.
It makes it all the more powerful.
And to take this guy who is 90-something and basically couldn't pay his electricity and deny him the help because I wasn't cool with something they had done 10 years prior. This was really unfolded over a long time.
Yeah.
That's when I became sort of more agitated, which then got declared, because then I was in, what's his name, interviewed me for the book Going Clear. I'm in that book. He interviewed me. Lawrence Wright interviewed me for that book. That got me in trouble. You know, I think that was the thing that really got me like, okay, now you're declared.
Dude. Yeah.
Now you're out.
Yeah. But you didn't have any family or...
No, I was fortunate. Friends, I was lucky that way. I didn't have family ties in. I wasn't going to lose a brother, a sister, a mother, a father if I took this stand. And Milton had passed away in 2008. So when he was alive, I was quiet because I was like, listen, man, this is your school. This is your, you have the primary relationship here. Mm-hmm. You know, I spoke with him honestly about it, but I stayed quiet. But he had passed away in 2008. It was my school now. So I was like, okay, I'm going to write a play.
What's with you and this connection to these old dudes that worked with L. Ron Hubbard? Didn't Mario Pfenniger also have interactions?
Yeah, I was going to mention, for people that don't know, Mario was a noted concert pianist. In his time, he was internationally.
And he started the original Paris Org, if I remember.
And he was an early advocate of Scientology. He was part of the original Celebrity Project to bring people in, and he himself had brought in some notable people.
Yeah,
he brought in David Campbell and a few other really notable people. So he was actually a kind of a big figure in Scientology. And he continued to have a school. He had, I forget his partner's name, but I know when my older son was 9, he wanted piano lessons, and that's who we took him to. His partner, you probably know
him. I can't remember his name. Yeah,
yeah, really sweet, really sweet guy. Was taught by
Ian.
Ian, yeah, great guy. He was teaching my son piano. So they were just these great guys.
I think we actually shot with Mario. Did he used to have that spot right off the 101?
Yeah. He lived in this really famous apartment that where they shot like Sunset Boulevard with, you know, like the movie.
It was like literally next.
It's in my play, you know.
Is it that same
first scene of the play that an adult student comes to him who has been referred to him by Scientology, although I never mentioned the name of the organization. And he says, 10,000 cars pass my window every day.
At least.
Goes, but you stopped. You came up the stairs. You know what I mean? Like that apartment was so amazing. Yes.
There. Yeah. Wow. I remember that apartment. Like, I used to take my son there for piano lessons. So
Wild.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Well, I think we're going to wrap it up, guys. We did. I think that was pretty good with Alan.
It was great.
Appreciate you.
This is amazing to see you guys. I mean, again, for people who may be watching this, I haven't seen either of these guys in 20 something years.
Yeah. Yes.
I read Mark's book when it came out, but I haven't seen you. And Mitch, I've thought about you so many times, wondering in, out, still. And I can't remember how your book came. I was like, instantaneously reading. I read that book in like one day.
Wow.
And I'm so happy that we were able to get in touch. I think Mike Rinder gave me your email or helped in some way. Yeah. I look forward to seeing you in person. And this to me, I was like, when you texted and said, would you want to do this thing? I was just like thrilled. Couldn't wait to cover some of this territory. It's amazing.
Right.
Nice. Well, we appreciate it. Let me just put up some, if you want to learn more about the Beverly Hills Playhouse, that's a link.
Beverly Hills Playhouse is still one of the big acting schools in LA. And since Milton passed away 15 years ago, I took over the school. And that's most of my activity these days is teaching there, running that business, and then as a playwright. If you want to find out about the school, we're still quite active.
And then you also wrote a book called The Oasis of Insanity, and that's the story of the Beverly Hills Playhouse. So if you want to read all
about it. It's the story of my mentor. The first part of it is the first 100 pages is the story of my mentorship with Milton, which is a classic old school story. And there's a whole chapter in there on Scientology because it was such a big part of his life and then my life. And I basically sort of declare what the new thing is for the Playhouse with regard to Scientology. But it tells all the story of Milton and what we alluded to in this talk of how he was like celebrated and then kind of kicked to the curb under the Miscavige regime. Right.
Nice. And then also we got Mitch's site. If you guys want to check out what Mitch is up to. And then Mitch also has a new book on Amazon, Scientology, the Big Lie. And you can check that out. And all these links are in the description as well. And thanks a lot, guys. I enjoyed this. I love it when we can get some new faces and some new stories on here. And provided in spades today.
Yeah.
Cool.
This really meant a lot to us, Alan. Thanks. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Such a pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Until next time.
Bye.
Thanks for watching. If you'd like to help support the channel, feel free to check out the merch store link in the description. We have Hail Xenu, Xenu is my homeboy, and BFG branded mouse pads, shirts, mugs, all sorts of other stuff in there that helps us to bring you new content on a regular basis. You can also pick up a copy of my book, Blown for Good, Behind the Iron Curtain of Scientology, in hardback, Kindle, and Audible versions as well. There's also a link to our podcast, and you can get that on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you'd like to watch another video, you can click on this link right here, or you can click on this one here, or you can click on the subscribe button right here. Thanks a lot. Until next time.